All right, it's a day later. It's still hot and muggy, but let's see if we can get through the second half of these questions. An eighth person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, thank you so very much for your teachings. I have enjoyed your books and all of your talks. Each reading or listening seems to help dismantle another layer of fantasy. I have a question about the Buddhist teaching that I have always found very confusing. When I listen to your teaching or other teachers who express non-duality, the idea of stages of understanding or enlightenment doesn't make any sense. In the suttas that I have read, the Buddha consistently talks about four stages on the path." And then he lists the four stages. Now, the Pali words for these stages are Sotapanna, Sakadagami, Anagami, and Arahat. And the English translation of those four stages are stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, and a fully enlightened Arahat. And this person goes on to ask, "What are these four stages that the Buddha talks about? Thank you so much, Daryl." In dealing with the Buddhist scriptures, the recorded teaching of the Buddha, one thing that we have to keep in mind is that this is a mixed bag of teachings that is recorded. So some of what he said is stated from an ultimate level, and some of what he said is expressed very much as a worldly view. So, for instance, at one point the Buddha was giving a teaching that mentioned certain individuals were reborn into different realms. And the monks who were hearing him give this teaching to the lay people, after he gave the teaching, these monks approached him and accused him of deliberately trying to mislead the public. Because this idea of rebirth, this teaching, that was very directly sounding like a reincarnation teaching was totally against the Buddhist teaching. It was against the actual teaching. So the monks were accusing him of deliberately misleading the public. And the Buddha expressed his notion that he wasn't really trying to mislead the public. It was simply that some people are inspired by this kind of teaching. So he was wanting to inspire people to investigate life. So this is similar to some of the teachings of Christ. At one point, the disciples of Christ asked him, like, "Why do you teach people these parables? Why don't you actually give them the real teaching?" And Christ states in the Bible, it's recorded in the Bible, that Christ replied that he didn't give the real teaching to anybody but his disciples, that the general public wasn't capable of understanding what the actual teaching was, so he didn't even bother to try to give them the real teaching. Instead, he gave the teaching only to his closest disciples. So we have this situation where the recorded teaching of many of these great spiritual leaders is a mixed bag of teachings, some of it being very much a worldly view and just as much a fantasy as anybody else's view, and other portions of it being what might be considered the essential teaching, the core teaching. So, in relation to this particular question that this person has about the apparent stages of enlightenment. Within the Buddhist scriptures, you have a teaching that says that all that's happening is beyond any possibility of description. That someone who comes to realize what actually is no longer attempts to describe what's happening in terms of physical form, feelings, perceptions, mental activities, or states of consciousness. That these kinds of descriptions literally do not apply to what actually is. And yet, in other instances, you have the Buddha mentioning these four stages of enlightenment or understanding. Now, it's indicated within the recorded scriptures of the Buddha that you're not even on the Buddhist path until you've reached the first level of enlightenment. And this stream enterer level is described as someone who's free from three basic notions or three basic notions. First of all, you're free of the belief in a self, a separate self. The second, you're free of particular doubts about the teaching. The third one is you are free of any attachment to rites and rituals, any particular rites and rituals of any particular tradition. According to the description of this this development, you still may fall prey to some of these notions, but ultimately you're free of them. So you can still kind of get caught up in old habits regarding these things, but ultimately you're not attached to these things anymore. The once returner starts becoming free of being attached to all of his or her sensual craving and free of anger and ill will. Again, you may still fall prey to these things out of habit, but the bottom line is you're no longer totally attached to your particular desires or your particular feelings of ill will or anger. The non-returner is someone who apparently is fully free from all of these things I just mentioned. And the arahat is free of five further things. So basically free of craving for fine material existence. So that's being attached to notions of being nothing. Free of craving for immaterial existence. Oh no, actually, wait a minute. Let me rephrase that. So the arahat is free of another five attachments. So the next one being craving for fine material existence. Now that's the notion that there's some kind of self that's still existing in some kind of ethereal way. And then there's craving for immaterial existence. So that would be notions of somehow there being an ultimate nothingness. Free of conceit around any notions of accomplishment. Free of restlessness, free of being attached to restlessness. So that would probably be free of restlessness for learning anything more or thinking that there was more to get to. And then ultimately, you are free of ignorance. So free of the notion that there is a self separate from existence, free of the notion that existence can be described in any way whatsoever, and free ultimately of the notion that life has any describable form whatsoever. And I'm reading this from something called the Buddhist Dictionary. It's a manual of Buddhist terms and doctrines, and it's by a very famous monk named Nyanatoloka Thera. I don't know if that's available commercially or not. Somehow I managed to get a hold of this. So that's generally the description of these four stages of awakening. And again, this is a worldly view. This description stands well within the world of fantasy. Ultimately, as the Buddha pointed out, these descriptions do not actually apply, do not truly apply to what's going on. So he called himself the Tathagata, which means one who is to thusness come or one who is to thusness gone. Now, most simply, that just means somebody who's come to what is, somebody who's able to acknowledge what is, the thusness or isness of the moment, the happening of this moment. And he made the statement that for someone who's come to what is, for someone who is acknowledging what actually is, that so-called person no longer attempts to describe life in terms of physical form, feelings, perceptions, mental activities, or states of consciousness. And if we consider these general terms in their full detail, that's basically all the descriptions that we have of existence. So he's stating outright that someone who comes to what actually is no longer attempts to describe life in any way because descriptions don't apply. Now, it doesn't mean that thoughts don't arise anymore, because there was another sutra in which he's speaking to his attendant, and the attendant is going on and on about all of these superpowers, apparently, that the Buddha has. And the Buddha said, you want to know another incredible thing that the Buddha can do? And his attendant says, well, you know, what? And the Buddha says, no matter what thoughts arise, that basically he's aware of a thought arising and passing and fading away. So when he says that one who has come to what actually is no longer attempts to describe life in terms of physical forms, feelings, perceptions, mental activities, or states of consciousness, he's simply saying that even though those thoughts still arise, those descriptions still arise, one who has come to what actually is no longer believes those descriptions as a true description of existence. So that would mean, ultimately, that everything the Buddha has said about existence ultimately doesn't apply. So even his teaching is what might be termed a dream for awakening dreamers, a fantasy for awakening from the fantasy. And that's all that's coming up in response to this question. So let's move on. Okay, another person has written in saying, Daryl, I hope you are well. Now, you probably got a whole heap of questions this month, since you had very few last month, and I guess that's the way the universe works. But I've got another for you. If you had time to reply to it, I'd be so grateful. If I'm not mistaken, you've mentioned Nathan Gill's being the bottom line. That's the title to one of Nathan Gill's books. And this person says he thinks that I've mentioned the title of this book in the past. And then he wonders if I could comment and interpret a section of the book. In the past, I wrote to you on the subject of how do I know there are other people and that this is not just a dream simulation. In Gill's book, one of the chapters is entitled "There Are No Others," which is why it caught my attention. Now, I won't, he goes on to quote a section of Nathan Gill's book, and I won't read that out in its entirety. But he's basically pointing out that the story of me is not real, is not ultimately the truth. But actually, the way he's chosen to say it, it says, if the story of me seems real, such that thoughts and sensations appear to a particular me, then the story of you, the story of an internal someone in another, will also seem real. If it's obvious that there is no one here, then it will also be obvious there's no one there. And in another section, he goes on to say that if the recognition arises that there are no others at all, that in fact there is simply no one, this life continues to unfold in a completely natural way, as if there are sentient others, as if there is an inner life, whether rich and joyous or sad and tormented, happening inside them. So this person who's written in is stating that those are Gill's quotes. They leave me a little cold, to be honest. It feels like the sort of thing a psychopath might say, or someone with no empathy. For example, saying that other human beings are just images, like on a cinema screen. I wonder if you could comment on his quotes. In particular, his statement that this perspective is a solipsism for no one. I've sometimes become gripped and terrified by the thought, which seems to be insurmountable in philosophy, of solipsism, that there is no way to prove that others exist. Gill seems to look closely at this problem and offers a bottom line solution, but it is still very confusing to get my head around this. I wonder if you might be able to clarify or debunk what Gill is saying here. All right. First of all, I haven't read Nathan's book, Being the Bottom Line. I've made reference in the past to Nathan's teaching being a bottom line teaching. Now, by that I simply mean that he doesn't spend time talking about unnecessary aspects of let me rephrase that. He doesn't spend time talking about unnecessary things. He simply jumps to the bottom line of a non-dual perspective, which is that there's just the happening of this moment. There's nothing that can be said that's true about the happening of this moment. And everything that occurs is the only thing that can occur. It's just this doing what it does. And it's simply an endless parade of appearances. Now, anyone who wants to hear it in Nathan Gill's terms can simply go to his website. He has a very simple short statement on what his perspective actually is. And in relation to what's being quoted here, this passage that is taken from this particular book, all I can really say in response to that is that sometimes in a discussion of a non-dual perspective, we get very much into the usual storylines, and sometimes it happens that someone starts saying that there are no others, there is no self, there is no world. And sometimes a discussion can focus on this way of presenting a non-dual perspective. And this is really simply offering a challenge to our usual perspective in life. But if the focus remains on this negation of what most people assume to be true, it can carry with it a kind of depressing quality. So if I start saying to you that there are no thoughts, and there is no love, and there are no people, and there is no world, and there is no choice, there is no free will, if I start presenting this in that way, it becomes very depressing. Even if it's actually true in a certain way, you know, really what I would be saying more is simply that the usual descriptions that we have of existence are not truly describing what's happening here. And so when that's realized, what's left is this kind of magical event of this moment, simply moving and shifting and dancing in the way that it moves and shifts and dances. And that, you know, we could say ultimately that that is the dance of nature, or the movement of a great unformed ocean of existence, or the presence of a great spirit. And those terms aren't attempting to describe what's actually happening here. It's simply pointing to this great, unformed, indescribable happening of this moment, this kind of magical expression of ever-changing appearances, which is ultimately stating that there are no people, there are no things, there are no thoughts, there is no love, there are no others, there is no choice, no free will. But it's also stating that even these descriptions that are a negation of all of this do not apply. So it's not saying there is no free will. It's saying descriptions of free will do not apply to what's happening here, and descriptions of destiny or fate do not apply to what's happening here. Descriptions of people do not actually tell us what's going on here. And descriptions that focus on denying all of these other descriptions, these do not apply either. In other teachings, people have pointed out that the descriptions do not apply, but the negation of the descriptions do not apply. So it's not this, and it's not this. Now, in relation to what this person who's written in has quoted from Nathan Gill's book, Even though I can't speak for Nathan Gill, what I do know of Nathan Gill's teaching, I would simply say that this particular portion of the book was attempting to challenge our usual assumptions about existence. And so he was very directly saying, there is no self, there are no others, there is no rich internal life. But he's not ultimately focusing on this negation of these usual descriptions. Ultimately, Nathan is pointing to the great and magical parade of passing appearances that life is. This kind of magical dance in which everything is simply expressed automatically. And that ultimately, there isn't any description that applies to this parade of passing appearances. To get totally absorbed in these descriptions that are saying there is no self, there is no others, there is no free will, there is no rich internal life, to get very much focused and on and absorbed in these descriptions is still not an acknowledgement of a non-dual sensibility. A non-dual sensibility is just stating outright that none of the descriptions of life apply to what's actually happening here. And they don't truly apply to what's happening here, even though on a day-to-day basis they appear to be very functional and we can use them for getting a glass of water or talking about our last vacation in Greece or wherever we went on vacation. These descriptions are not an ultimate description of existence. And the focus on the negation of these descriptions, or the focus on saying that there are no people, there is no free will, there is no world, there are no thoughts, to focus on those descriptions is still not a non-dual sensibility. To believe that from this non-dual perspective, to believe that any description is somehow going to be an accurate description of existence, this is against the non-dual sensibility. So as this person writes at the very end, he's saying that Nathan's descriptions are very confusing and very difficult to wrap his head around. So he's having great difficulty in coming to any great clarity through these descriptions that Nathan is offering. And yes, that's the fact. That's the basic fact. Anytime you're focusing on thought, you are ultimately going to be left confused. If there is a belief that there is some ultimate description of existence, whether it's a positive or a negative, a non-dual sensibility is saying that no description applies to what's happening here. I can't even ultimately say there's something happening here. And with that, these apparent thoughts, what we call thoughts, you know, I don't even know what those are. What we call descriptions, I don't know what those are because within my storyline, I have the story that somebody taught me to bark that sound when someone pointed to these apparent forms. But if I try to sit down and observe one particular thought, I can't do it. Thought is somehow some flowing stream of some kind. And I've simply been taught to bark the sounds, description, or thoughts. So I don't really know what this apparent stream of events is. But it happens anyway. I don't have to be able to describe it. I don't have to be able to explain what it actually is. I don't have to explain what I am. I don't know what I am. I don't know what any of this is. And from this non-dual perspective, that's okay, because it all happens anyway. The apparent world occurs, the apparent thought occurs. It's all just this moving, shifting, spontaneous happening. And it's not necessary to understand it in any way. It's not necessary to intellectually attempt to wrap your head around it. What head? Whose head? What intellect? All of these are just meaningless sounds. And any time we get, you know, they're meaningless sounds attempting to describe forms that don't literally exist, don't actually exist. And any time we get absorbed in meaningless sounds pointing to forms that don't actually exist, and we attempt to come up with some true statement about existence, it's just incredibly frustrating. All right, that's all that's coming up in response to that. So I've had another person write in saying, "Hey, Daryl, something came to my all my being, something or nothing. Is it true that happiness, not apparent happiness or the concept of happiness, is nothing and nobody?" And he writes "nothing and nobody" in capital letters. "The feelingless feeling, this feelingless feeling is all the time with me, and it equals nothing and nobody. And it also is arising with my apparent I and his life altogether. I hope that you comprehend all this scratchy cryptography, funny writing." And then he goes on to say, "Yes, apparently yes, apparently Eureka, nothing happening, and yet everything does apparently happen. This together is happening of inexplicable great event as long as you take, and whatever happened, let it happen, because it will happen anyway. Thank you, Daryl, for the push to jump into the pool of inexplicable, unpredictable, uncontrolled, wild dance of this," and then he leaves a blank space, "whatever. Thank you, Daryl, and like Spock saying, live long and prosper." And then he adds a P.S. "The great, inexplicable, unpredictable, uncontrolled, wild dance of happening did not bestow me with great gift for grammar, but she gave me a gift for expressing wild." So this is simply someone who is relating very strongly to what's being presented on the website, and is very much connecting with the sense of life being an unexplainable, unpredictable, uncontrolled dance of something that can't be described. Just the happening of this moment, doing what it does. And I don't know whether he's truly asking a question here, but he's asking, is it true that happiness, not apparent happiness or the concept of happiness, is nothing and nobody? And by nothing and nobody, he's simply referring to this totally unexplainable dance of this moment. And he's asking, is that happiness? And what I get from what he's written here is that he's not saying everything feels good all the time. He's simply pointing to the fact that there's a great relief in the sense that all of this is simply happening on its own, that it's not a personal issue. It's not a matter of my personal successes and my personal failures, that the whole thing is some magical dance of something that can't be described in any way whatsoever. And I use the word magical here just in relation to the fact that it's all happening spontaneously, automatically. There's no way of saying what it is, and ultimately whatever is seems to be occurring is simply occurring on its own. And so we're left with this wild dance of ups and downs, apparent ups and downs, the wild dance of apparent things and an apparent person, but it's not truly things, you know, describable things, and it's not truly a describable self. The whole thing is just this totally unexplainable, unformed, spontaneous event. Now, would I say that's happiness? I wouldn't use the word happiness. I mean, within spiritual traditions, they often use the word joy. Happiness most often refers to a passing state of mind. You have happiness and sadness. But within a spiritual realization, or along with a spiritual realization, there may be a feeling of great joy. And joy is more a reference to the richness of life, the richness of this great mysterious dance that includes incredible levels of unhappiness and incredible levels of happiness, incredible situations of confusion and incredible situations of clarity and incredible situations of courage or confidence and incredible situations of fear and anxiety. And the word joy refers to this rich expression of whatever this is. So in a way, yes, I could say that joy equals nothing and nobody. And by that, it would be saying that joy is basically the acknowledgement of this unexplainable, unformed, magical dance of this moment, that on a deep level, there's an appreciation for the fact that there's no explanation for it whatsoever, and even though the passing appearances aren't any ultimate truth, the passing appearances are incredibly rich. And that ultimately there is no personal quality to any of this. It's also the fact there's no impersonal quality to any of this. These descriptions do not apply. But within the world of apparent form and within the world of apparent storylines, the whole thing takes on a kind, may take on a kind of magical quality, and there may be a very deep appreciation for the richness of whatever this is, this wide variety of expression, this wide variety of apparent experience. There may be an appreciation of the magical quality of it, the richness of it, and the fact that it's just the wildest ride in existence. It's wilder than any ride in any great theme park in any part of the world. All right, another person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, what is Atman, and how do you relate to the concept of soul? In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna refers to the body as that which is impermanent, and the Atman as that which is permanent. This is a dualistic perspective of the Samkhya philosophy. Ramana was talking about the self/awareness, with a capital A, with a capital S and a capital A, and the Buddha was denying the concept of Atman/self altogether. I do not find any Atman within me, so I think I didn't get it yet. When someone is so identified with their thoughts, some teachers tell them that they can witness their mind, so they are not, so to realize that they are not their minds, but something prior to the mind. The Buddha was asking people to be mindful. Please shed some light on all of this." Um, Okay, the quickest way to offer some clarity on these kinds of confusions is simply to point to the fact that, once again, these great collection of teachings, whether it be the Buddhist teaching or the teachings of Advaita, these teachings are a mixed bag of teachings. Some of the teachings are still very much coming from a worldly view, and other statements within the teachings come more from the core aspect of the teaching, or the bottom line of the teaching, meaning the most basic teaching. And that cuts through a lot of the worldly statements that are within these various bodies of teachings. So, both from a Buddhist perspective and from an Advaita perspective, the bottom line teaching with regard to descriptions about existence is that none of the descriptions apply. So whether we read the Ashtavakra Gita or we read the Buddhist scriptures, certain portions of the Buddhist scriptures, it states outright that no description applies to what's happening here. No description whatsoever. Now, if that's acknowledged as being true from our own experience, then there's no need to get confused about any other description of existence. There's no need to get confused about descriptions of existence, because none of them apply. None of them are truly describing what's happening in this moment. And I can add to that that from my own experience, these descriptions are filled with contradiction. So a description is attempting to describe apparent forms, because that's all we can describe, an apparent form. Now, the fact of the matter is that all of us have the experience that everything in life is changing. So if our bottom line sense of existence, our most essential feeling about existence, is that everything that we know of is changing, whether it's changing slowly, like the planet, or it's changing quickly, like the movement of our thoughts, our basic experience of life is that everything is changing. So now if we sit down and we attempt to describe life in terms of form, we have to be frustrated. We must ultimately be frustrated, because that's attempting to give form to life when in fact there ultimately is no form to life. That's a major contradiction. And for most of us, our essential feeling about existence is that everything is changing. So it doesn't really matter how much it's possible to look out and see a form and describe that form with some meaningless sound that we've been taught to bark. Our most essential feeling is that that form that we're looking at is changing to some degree. So if we cling to the description of that form as some ultimate description of reality, it just doesn't work. It's always in contradiction to the fact that life is moving and shifting and dancing. And if we spend our time focused on forms and the descriptions of form, spend our time focused on this world of meaningless sound, meaningless symbols, they only take on meaning when they point to these apparent forms, and these forms don't ultimately exist. So that's a total world of fantasy. Even though on a day-to-day basis it's helpful to say, may I have a glass of water? How do I get to this particular mall? Even though these descriptions seem to be helpful on a day-to-day basis, they present a major contradiction to how life is actually expressing itself. And if we stay focused on these fantastic stories of form, we will find ourselves constantly frustrated by the fact that life is moving and shifting and changing. Because the more we stay focused on the notion of form, the more we anticipate that life is going to be standing still. But it doesn't stand still. We describe our relationship in a certain way, but the relationship changes from moment to moment. We get up in the morning and it's, oh, I love you, I can't live without you. And then by nightfall, it's like, who needs you? I don't need this crap. I'm getting out of here. We focus on passing moments of happiness. And we start thinking, oh, finally, I've got it made. I've really figured it all out. I'm going to be happy from this point on. And then the next day, the whole world crumbles. Something occurs and our whole sense of confidence and clarity just falls apart. And that's the natural dance of existence, but there may be this focus on descriptions of particular forms, and this particular focus on a form gives us the impression that somehow life has a particular form, and we anticipate that it's going to have a particular form. And we very naturally focus on those forms that seem to be very pleasant, thinking that, all right, finally life has arrived at this one particular place, and this is where it's going to stay, and it's wonderful, and I finally figured it all out. And then an hour later, the whole thing falls apart because life doesn't have a particular form. It's an ongoing dance of ever-shifting appearances, sometimes up, sometimes down, apparently, moving and shifting and dancing in whatever way it moves and shifts and dances. So very specifically, in response to this person's question, he's pointing out that some groups talk about the Atman, or the Big Self with a capital S. Ramana Maharshi was talking about the Big Self with a capital S, and he equated that with awareness with a capital A. The Buddha was denying the concept of the Atman with a capital A and the Self with a capital S. Some teachers talk about being mindful. The Buddha apparently taught about being mindful of the passing events of life, the passing forms of life, the full event of life. Within the Advaita traditions, the non-dual traditions, they talk about observing the passing events or the passing things in life in order to realize that what we are is something apart or prior to, apart from or prior to these passing events and various things. And this person is wondering how to reconcile all of this. Now, it doesn't really matter what I say about this. There's going to be somebody who has some contradictory sense of it. So, my own sense of this is that the Atman is the Big Self of existence. Now, in my sense of this, how this was traditionally used, it's not something describable. The word Atman is pointing to the totally unexplainable, unformed happening of this moment. There isn't any description for it, so it's not some personal self, some personal big self that can be described. It's a word for pointing to the indescribable, just the happening of this moment. And it is again supporting the notion that no description applies to life. No description applies truly applies to what's happening here and now. Not even the terms here and now, not even the term happening. There can be no intellectual truth regarding what is. I can't even say what is. And that's from my reading of Ramana Maharshi in the past. I haven't done any much present reading of Ramana Maharshi, but when he used the word self with a capital S or awareness with a capital A, he also wasn't talking about something that was describable. He also had another term. It was just existence. So self with a capital S, awareness with a capital A, was the same as existence, just ordinary existence, the happening of this moment. And ultimately he was saying none of that was describable. It wasn't divided up into different parts. It was just an unformed, unexplainable happening. The happening of this moment. Now, it's true that in some traditions, in the Advaita traditions, even within the Ashtavakra Gita, it's referring to us as being awareness. And within these traditions, often they will say, just start observing everything that arises and passes, and realize that you're not that, that you are actually what it is that's observing. But ultimately, within the Advaita traditions, this notion of existence is negated. Because within something like the Ashtavakra Gita, it's ultimately stating that whatever is happening in this moment, whatever this is, it has no particular form and it cannot be described in any true way. So even the notion that there's some separate self observing is a totally ridiculous notion. Now the Buddha, it's recorded that the Buddha taught mindfulness practice. So that practice is described very succinctly in a sutra titled The Four Foundations of Mindfulness. But in that description, like, people often only focus on this one aspect of observing everything arising and passing away. The Buddha had four sections to this Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And in the final section, he's asking you to consider all of these mental descriptions of existence and the fact that they don't apply to what's actually happening. And so in this mindfulness practice, one aspect of it is to come to realize from your own experience that existence has no particular form and there can be no actual description, ultimately, of existence. Once again, he ultimately describes, not in this particular sutra, but in other areas, he was recorded as saying, one who comes to what actually is no longer attempts to describe life in terms of physical forms, feelings, perceptions, mental activities, or states of consciousness. These do not apply to what's actually going on here. And in other areas, he basically points out that what is, but these descriptions don't apply. And by that, he was simply meaning they don't apply in any true way, because in other areas, he described how thoughts and feelings still arose within him, still apparently arose within him, what we would call thoughts and feelings, would still arise in him. Even though those descriptions don't truly describe what's happening here. Okay, and finally, this same person wrote in again saying, hi Daryl, this week I finished 2 years of yoga teacher's training. I was teaching one student for 8 months and was always reminding that person to come back to the experiencing of this moment. Then in viewing Muji Satsang on the internet, I always get the feeling that he's speaking about something beyond the event of this moment, some ultimate witness. He never speaks about suffering and gives the impression he is completely liberated. You, and he's referring to me, you are speaking about the formless event of this moment. Muji says he is life and the witness of life, and he gives priority to awareness, which does not change, and he does not give the emphasis on the changing appearances, or give the emphasis to the changing appearances. The term Atman, as described in the Bhagavad Gita, also gives an impression of something beyond the event of this moment. Kashmiri Shaivism, I'm not sure how to pronounce that word, is a non-dual philosophy tantric teaching, and the yogis used to describe the event of this moment as being Shiva, being consciousness, and Shakti is its energy, and they are one. So Tantra is close to describing the event of this moment. The old yogis practicing with the Samkhya philosophy tried to realize themselves as pure consciousness beyond manifestation. Nirvana, as the Buddha described it, seems to be different from the samsaric existence. Ramana's existence seemed to be more peaceful than mine, and he was the real deal, one who seemed to be liberated absolutely. Would you please refer to this, to all of this in your talk? Patiently waiting. All right, so this time the question is basically focusing on the fact that some teachers appear to be referring to something that is separate from our usual experience of the moment, and other teachings seem to be simply referring to the happening of the moment. Now, he mentions this teacher, Muji, and I'm not familiar with this person's teaching at all. So I don't feel that I can make any comment about that person's teaching. However, he goes on to describe that the term Atman, as described in the Bhagavad Gita, gives the impression of something beyond the event of this moment. Actually, in my reading of the Bhagavad Gita, it does not, because in Arjuna's dialogue with Krishna, Krishna is ultimately Atman, and in one portion of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna has this realization, and he says to Krishna, "You are in everything," and then he stops himself and he says, "No, you are everything that's appearing." So once again, this notion of separation is negated, and Atman, the word Atman in the traditional Hindu sense, is basically a reference to the essence of this moment, the actuality of this moment. And so the word Atman is simply pointing to this unformed, unexplainable happening of this moment. And within the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is, you might loosely say, the worldly aspect of Atman. A kind of personalized version of the indescribable Atman. And Arjuna has this realization that Krishna is not in everything. Krishna is everything. Everything that we're seeing right now, everything that's being experienced, apparently experienced right now, that is Krishna. That is Atman. So this person goes on to say that in the Tantra traditions, it's more closely just a reference to the happening of this moment. But within the Sankhya philosophy, people were trying to realize themselves as pure consciousness beyond manifestation. Now, perhaps we can note that it's not consciousness that they were trying to realize themselves as. they were trying to realize themselves as pure consciousness. And my only experience of this term, pure consciousness, would come through teachers such as Ramana Maharshi. And Ramana was very carefully in certain places pointing out that the term pure consciousness is pointing to something that can't be described in any way whatsoever. So even the term pure consciousness can't be applied to it. It simply points to it. He points out that nirvana, as the Buddha described it, seemed to be different from the usual existence of life, the world of samsara, the world of suffering. But actually, if we read the Buddha's description of nirvana very carefully, one of his descriptions is that it's the absence of any dependency on formation. So nirvana is getting to a place where you're not thinking in terms of formation. Ultimately, you're not believing this notion of form. And so you're not trying to depend on certain forms to bring you happiness, because you realize that life is moving up and down and all around. It has no particular form. So to try to depend on a particular thing to make you happy is only going to bring you suffering. And nirvana, the peace of nirvana, nirvana is the absence of any dependency on form. Nirvana is the absence of any focus on the belief in form. It's the absence of the belief in form. And the realization that life is an unformed, unexplainable happening. And the Buddha's day-to-day existence was a lot rougher than your particular day-to-day existence in general. I mean, there are some people's lives, some apparent people's lives, who are a lot worse than what the Buddha had. But the Buddha had to suffer through excruciating back pain to the point that he couldn't really function at certain points. He had to suffer through famine. He died of food poisoning after weeks of vomiting and diarrhea. His life wasn't a picnic. And Ramana's teaching, at one point, he had one line where he said, unless you have a mind that's able to kind of set aside the suffering of existence, he said basically that one who is indifferent to pain or pleasure is the only one that can be happy. So he's not saying that with realization there's no longer pain or pleasure. He's saying that with realization you become indifferent to pain or pleasure. Because the focus is on this larger mysterious event of life as having no form, no possible description, and that's the reality, this great, indescribable, unformed happening. And the focus goes on that and is no longer swayed by pain or pleasure that comes and goes. So ultimately, even though those pains and pleasures still arise, and even though there may be somewhat of a focus on those pains or pleasures, there's no ultimate feeling that life is pain or life is ultimately pleasure, because it's something bigger that is expressing itself in certain moments in what we call pain, and in other moments what we call pleasure. But ultimately, all of it is nobody's doing. It's just this great mysterious event or presence. And he would use words like self with a capital S, or awareness with a capital A, or pure consciousness, but he would also use the word existence as being the equal to self with a capital S, awareness with a capital A, pure consciousness. It's also simply existence, the feeling of existing right now in this moment. That's the big self. That's the Atman. That's pure consciousness, just this totally unexplainable, unformed happening. Just this happening now. And he would very specifically point out that there isn't a self somewhere else. There isn't this pure consciousness somewhere else. It's not, whatever this is, it's not divided up into different portions. It's just this. So as certain Buddhist traditions point out, that nirvana is samsara. Nirvana is just the day-to-day existence of suffering, but it's not described in terms of form. It's not focusing on the notion of form. Nirvana is the absence of any dependency on form or the absence of any belief in form. So it's the basic happening of this moment. Nirvana is samsara, but it's the absence of any belief in form. And any attempt to depend on certain forms to bring us happiness. And as Ramana Maharshi points out, that still expresses itself as pain and pleasure, but only a mind or only a so-called person that can become indifferent to the pains and pleasures can be free, can find the basic happiness of the big self. And the way one apparently becomes indifferent to pain and pleasure within Ramana's teaching, or the way they do become indifferent to pain and pleasure, is to realize that whatever this is, these descriptions of pain and pleasure are not ultimately the truth, that it is this larger, unexplainable, unformed happening, simply happening on its own, expressing all apparent things. And some of the apparent things it expresses are moments of pain and moments of pleasure. Those don't disappear. Ramana died of cancer, experiencing incredible pain, incredible physical pain. And when they asked him, when the doctors asked him if he wanted some kind of medicine in order to alleviate the pain, he said, "No, it's not my personal pain, it's just the pain of life." And he had no interest in attempting to escape the pain. Now, don't get the impression that if you become realized, then you'll just become totally indifferent to pain, that pain won't bother you. Because it's also the case that the Buddha, when he was giving a teaching at certain times, his back pain became so excruciating that he had to give up teaching and let somebody else finish that particular teaching while he lay down on the ground behind that person in order to alleviate the pain. Anyway, that's all that's coming up in response to this particular question, and that brings us to the end of the questions. And actually, that last question naturally leads to a general comment that I've been wanting to make about these non-dual presentations. Very obviously, a lot of these non-dual teachings are presented in some glorified manner. The way they're presented, they give you the impression that there's some glorious result to a non-dual perspective, something that's way beyond our everyday life, way beyond the everyday confusions, way beyond the everyday unhappiness of existence, way beyond the pains and difficulties of ordinary life. And often the way these are presented, it gives the impression that the person presenting this non-dual perspective is way beyond anything that relates to an ordinary human being. They're just so ultimately transcended. It's just unbelievable. And I simply want to say that that's a bunch of crap. What might be referred to as a non-dual awakening, a non-dual realization, is the simple acknowledgement that this moment, this ordinary everyday moment, is the Atman, is the unexplainable, unformed, mysterious dance of something that can't ever truly be described. And to realize that does not get rid of the happening. It's simply saying that what we usually take to be our small personal life, with all of its pains and pleasures, its clarities, its confusions, its joys, its sorrows, it's not some personal little life that can be described in those ways. But to realize it is an unformed, undescribable happening, simply happening on its own, that everything that we apparently are is simply an expression of this larger, unexplainable, unformed dance of existence. To realize that does not get rid of the dance of existence or how it's expressing itself. So even though we can't ultimately call it my personal pain or my personal pleasure, the happening that we usually call personal pain and personal pleasure, that still presents itself. Nirvana is not some place other than the happening of this moment. Nirvana is simply the realization that whatever's happening in this moment, it has no particular form. And so all of this frustrating attempt to describe life as a bunch of forms, all of this frustrating attempt to hang on to one particular expression of existence, all of that frustrating effort falls away. Because there's the ultimate realization that life is a moving, shifting, dancing event that can't ultimately be described. It doesn't express only one apparent thing. It will move on to whatever it's going to move on its own. And so, ultimately, to acknowledge that is to acknowledge that the so-called pleasant moments will simply have to be appreciated. And they'll be appreciated even more than usual because we know they're fleeting. And those so-called difficult situations, those painful situations, will have to be endured because there's no way to escape them. There is only this totally mysterious dance of existence presenting itself in whatever way it presents itself. Now, before I get ranting in any over-the-top fashion, let me add that I am simply expressing what might be classically termed a non-dual perspective. And my sense of it is not some far-out sense of it. It's very much in alignment with what is traditionally expressed as a non-dual sensibility. And in fact, I wouldn't even be using the term non-duality if somebody else hadn't labeled my expression as a non-dual expression. And so, in order to find out if that was appropriate, I investigated what is traditionally known as a non-dual perspective, and the deepest teachings of that traditional perspective. And so, yeah, non-duality is fine. I don't mind having my perspective being labeled a non-dual perspective, although even that's a bunch of crap. In the oldest non-dual teachings, they also point out that duality and non-duality are a fantasy, that what is can't be described in any way whatsoever. So I'm just wanting to point out that the glorification of this teaching, the glorification of people who are expressing this perspective, the glorification of these so-called individuals to the point that this starts seeming to be some magical accomplishment, something that's way beyond the capacity of an ordinary human being, all of that is crap from the traditional sense of non-duality, the traditional sense of non-dual awakening. If we look at the lives of the Buddha, if we look at the lives of any of the great teachers like Christ through history, their lives were very difficult lives. Their lives had a lot of pain. Their lives had certain confusions. Their lives had great difficulties. Their so-called awakening didn't remove them from those difficulties and pains. It simply let them acknowledge those difficulties and pains from a larger perspective, so that it wasn't poor little me, poor little ordinary, unenlightened me. It was the realization that every so-called person, everything, is this larger, unexplainable, unformed event simply expressing itself. It's a divine mystery, or a divinely mysterious presence, or a divinely mysterious happening or eventing. Anyway, everything that I offer here is simply asking you to acknowledge your own experience of life. A non-dual perspective can have no power unless it's acknowledged to be a clear description of your own experience, or a clear reference to your own actual experience. It's your experience, your apparent experience of life, that can support a non-dual perspective. And it's only your direct experience of life that can give any power to a non-dual perspective. And once again, a non-dual perspective is not the one true way of looking at life. It's not the most profound expression of nature. It's just one of life's mysterious expressions. If you apparently relate to an apparent non-dual perspective, if an apparent you apparently relates to an apparent non-dual perspective, that's wonderful. But if an apparent you does not apparently relate to an apparent non-dual perspective, that's also wonderful, because the whole thing is just a totally unexplainable happening the way it happens. It's not people that are ignorant and people that are awakening. It's just always a totally mysterious event eventing the way it events. And every apparent expression of this unformed, unexplainable happening is a legitimate expression of it, because every apparent expression is the unformed, unexplainable happening. A non-dual presenter is not somehow more divine than the people listening, the apparent people listening to this apparent non-dual presenter. An apparent non-dual perspective is not more divine. It's not more divinely mysterious than any other perspective on life. All of it is unexplainable. All of it is the expression of this unformed, unexplainable happening. There is only the happening of this moment, what we would call the happening of this moment, and that cannot truly be described in any way whatsoever. There is no evidence that it has a form of any kind. So there's just this doing what it does. And everything that occurs is just this doing what it does. All of this is simply for your consideration. I'm not asking you to believe it. I'm not saying that this is the one true sense of existence. I'm not saying that this sense of existence is better than any other sense of existence. I'm simply presenting what would classically be known as a non-dual perspective. If you relate to it, great. If you don't relate to it, that's great, because life will be expressing you in some other way. And any other way is also a legitimate expression of this unformed, unexplainable happening. So that's it, folks. Until next time, I hope that life presents you with good things. However, I know it's going to present you with a vast range of apparent things. Until next time, take care. Bye.